welcome to the Wednesday rant. I'm John St. Augustine, and I'm delighted to have you with me one more time. You know, this is often called Wednesday Wisdom, which is like a hashtag thing. When I was in high school, by the way, the hashtag was called a pound sign. I don't know who changed it. Hash to me is like something my grandmother would make with corned beef. But anyway, it could be Wednesday Wisdom, but it's not going to be. I don't know that I have much in me today that is wise, that I could possibly pass along in any way, shape, or form. And of course, wisdom is very subjective. Wisdom only comes out of making bad decisions, right? If you make enough bad decisions over a period of time, and if you learn from them, you are all of a sudden anointed as a wise person. Nobody's born wise. I think that we have to have our ass handed to us multiple times in our life to at least wake up a little bit and extract some sort of lessons from those things that maybe we can do to improve our experience of being alive a little bit more and pass it on to other people that we're on this little blue ball hurtling through space, which is really the focus of the Wednesday rant. I'm a NASA guy, always have been. I did a talk, 8 years ago for NASA at Langley Air Force Base. I was overwhelmed and thrilled at the very same time. This was in November of 2009. And to stand on stage in front of 3,000-4,000 of the smartest humans on the planet was, for this country boy, wow. And it was an interesting process to get to the point where I was able to do that. I was approached in 2008, actually, to do this thing in 2009. And a TED Talk, for those of you who do not know what they are, is about technology, entertainment, and design. And the concept was, when they started, was to have these talks that could be put up for people to learn from those three disciplines: technological, entertainment, which is where I fell in, sure wasn't the technology, and then some sort of design piece. And that's really what the umbrella started out as. Now, I think in so many ways, it's become a huge deal, and I think that's a good thing. However, it becomes watered down like a lot of things, and you know, there are people that hire people to help them get a TED Talk so it looks good on their resume, whatever. So it took literally 6-8 months. I was approached in 08 and didn't happen until late in 09. And at the time, I think part of the reason I was asked was the work that I had done in radio for, at that point, a dozen years, had gained some notice and some notoriety and some moment for people on a national level. I was working with Oprah Radio then, and I was Dr. Oz's senior producer, and I produced the Gene Chatsky Show and had a team of people, great people working with me. We did some incredible work there and, you know, kind of bend the energy spectrum a little bit to the positive. That's one of the things I think that is most lacking in the media today. And I'm not talking about a cat in a tree story. I'm talking about real conversations with real people that can really make a difference. So anyway, all that being said, once I was approached, I was thrilled, and I thought, so what do you want me to talk about? And the TED Talk is very specific in its timing. So you get a 7-minute, a 14-minute, or like a 21-minute. They're all chunked down in 7-minute pieces. And I had 7 minutes initially to come up with an idea to add to the concept of the very first TED Talk at NASA, which was called The Space to Create. That's a pretty broad term. So I actually submitted 2 or 3 proposals, what I thought I could do in 7 minutes, to a crowd of people who, you know, my best grades in school were lunch and gym. I mean, what do you want me to tell these people? So the first two got turned down, actually. And, you know, that's not what they're looking for. And I'm thinking, but you approached me, so how am I not fitting here? And I sat back after a while, and I remembered the lunar landing, the landing on the moon in 1969, in July of 1969. And I remembered how, for me, life changed that day as a 10-year-old. And at the very same time, I was more interested at that point in the Chicago Cubs playing the Philadelphia Phillies. Ron Santo apparently at that day went out 4-for-4. So it was a huge thing in my world. But it was also a day that my dad had his monthly poker party at our house. And then so all the uncles would come over and the aunties would be in tow. And then the aunties would go to the living room and play pinochle. And all the old men would play poker in the dinette area. And I was a gopher. And so I went back and forth and back and forth most of the day. They, you know, came over 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon, stayed till way past midnight as usual. And I would stay up late and I'd run back and forth out to the yard because there was this huge tub of beer and soda and what have you floating around in ice for hours. And so I was the gopher. I'd run and get Uncle Chuck a beer. I'd go get Uncle Frank a beer. I'd go get Auntie Margaret a beer or a soda. I'm not saying my Auntie Margaret knew how to slug back some Schlitz, but she sure did. And so I would get little tips. And, you know, the money they had on the table, some of those quarters and dimes would find their way into my pocket. So it was a big, big gig for me when they came over to our house. But it was the exact same day that they were going to land on the moon. And I remembered that and recalled that. And I thought, well, maybe there's a seven-minute segment that can work. And that's what they – it all pivoted on one thing. It pivoted on that clip, that famous clip, when man first stepped on the moon and said, one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind. I needed to be able to use that clip as a prop, so to speak. And the only other thing that came to mind was I had the guy that was driving me around for a couple days at Langley find me a rubber baseball, because I wanted to offset that and make some point that, you know, baseball was important. And if I looked up in the sky, look for the moon, it looked the size of a baseball. It's 150,000 miles from here. It looks like a baseball to me. So I made that connection, and NASA cleared the clip. It's maybe 9 seconds, 12 seconds, something like that, out of a seven-minute talk. So I had to put the thing together, did all that. And there's no rehearsals, really, when you do a TED Talk. I mean, you kind of, here's what you're going to do, and here's where you go. And they want it all to be very spontaneous. And when I got to Langley, Mitch Albom, who is a great author and a great radio guy in Detroit, he was kind of the anchor at the last guy on the docket for the day. And he and I were sitting backstage watching some of the other people talk. And he looks at me and goes, what are we doing here? Yeah, I get that. So you can find it. I'm not going to go into the whole talk. I kind of gave you most of it here. There's a reason I brought it up, and I want to get onto that, because it really was all about perspective to me. And I maintained that the reason I did that talk that day, those 7 minutes, goes back to when I was 10, and how for everybody on the planet who was alive at that point was witness to something that humans had never accomplished before. And the reasons for that accomplishment were varied in many. The space race, the Cold War, you name it, that all that's there. But the fact of the matter is, it happened. And there was a three-part process that made it happen, or allowed it to happen, or brought it forth, which is people had to, you know, think about it for a very long time, look up at the moon and go, wow, how do we get there? And then they had to talk about it for an even longer time. So, okay, so how do we get there? And then there's the final, the act itself, the deed of, you know, now we're headed there. And my experience, observation, and opinion has been over my lifetime that that's pretty much a three-part process for everything in life. And so that's really what I brought to the table. So you could find that on YouTube. It's from November of 2009 at Langley for NASA. So fast forward to yesterday, and some of the Apollo astronauts were in Chicago at the Museum of Science and Industry. And Bill Curtis, my good friend and vaunted legendary broadcaster, was interviewing them. And I caught pieces of that here and there. And back then when that happened, there was no such thing as video games like there is now. So to me, it was like there's, you know, at the time there was like 5 billion people on the planet. We all got to see a real life, holy shit, I never thought I'd see this experience ever. And it's like, you know, when the Cubs won the World Series. Holy shit, I never thought I'd see this. The moon thing's a little higher up, but you get my drift. And so looking at things that way set myself, and I believe the people that were in attendance there and some of the people that watched that video, in another direction, because we achieved something that we never thought we could achieve. We had accomplished something that was nobody else had accomplished. And I don't think pride is the right word that goes with it, but a deep sense of belonging is something that's always stayed with me. And so when I recounted on that talk for TED, that was the thing I came away with most. So yesterday when I knew that they were in town, some of the Apollo astronauts, and Bill was doing this interview with them, and my friend Candace Jordan, who you're going to hear in a future podcast, was also there kind of reporting on it. She does the Candid Candace column for the Chicago Tribune. I happened across yesterday on Netflix, I believe it was, or one of the zillion channels, on a documentary. and it's called For All Mankind. It was done in 1989, and it's really a documentary with original footage of the Apollo program, which, of course, as I said, we all know, successfully landed the first humans on the moon from 69 to 72. That was right in my wheelhouse, man. 10 years old to 14, I mean, come on with it. That was big-time stuff. And they interviewed Jim Lovell, who was on Apollo 8, Apollo 13, Michael Collins, who was on 11, Charles Conrad, who was on Apollo 12, Jack Swigert, Rusty Swigert, who was on Apollo 13, and Ken Mattingly, who was on Apollo 16. And the title for the documentary comes from President John F. Kennedy's address to Rice University on the nation's space effort back in 1962, September of 62. And it was slightly altered, but this is what JFK said back in 1962. Quote, "The exploration of space will go ahead whether we join it or not. It is one of the greatest adventures of all time. We set sail on this new sea because there is new knowledge to be gained and new rights to be won, and they must be won and used for all people. We choose to go to the moon. We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do other things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard." So I'm watching this documentary, I'm watching these guys, and now this stuff looks so antiquated. You know, there was a time when the space shuttle would go up and down and people stopped watching. It was like the fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth story on the news. Yeah, it's old hat now. People acclimate to this stuff real quick. But back then, it was the shits. So I'm watching this documentary footage yesterday, and they started talking about the most famous photograph in the history of humankind. It's called Earthrise. And the picture was taken as the module was actually spinning on its rotating on its axis in order to keep the temperature inside this tiny little box that these guys were flying in. I've heard it said, I don't know if it's 100% true, but I wouldn't be surprised that there's more technology in our cell phones than there was in that first lunar module. I would not be surprised. We have more technology at our fingertips than they had back then to get to the frickin' moon and back. That's impressive shit. So this photograph is called Earthrise, and it was taken with looking over the shoulder of the moon back at our little blue planet floating in a sea of black. And they're talking, all the astronauts were talking about what that meant to them, how that affected them, how those things changed them. So it was actually astronaut Bill Anders who was in the lunar orbit in 1968 during that Apollo 8 mission, and he just rolled just the right way, and he caught the, like I said, the shoulder of the moon, and in the background against this incredible blackness is our planet. It's been said it's the most influential environmental photograph ever taken. I cannot disagree with that, because it's all about perspective. And then these guys, to a man, started talking about how they realized that all their problems, all their wants, all their worries, all their ups, all their downs, all the divisions in the world, all their everything that they thought made them who they are was 150,000 miles away in this little tiny spot. And their perspective changed in an instant, much like mine did as a 10-year-old looking at this image on our Sears black and white television of a guy putting his foot on the moon. I mean, it was a serious shift in consciousness for me. Didn't make me want to be an astronaut, but it made me go, wow, that's amazing. And that thought, that feeling has stayed with me every time I look at this Earthrise picture. You've seen it. You know what I'm talking about. But then it started to roll into other things for me. Go figure. And the same day, which was yesterday, that documentary aired, a report was come out by 91 leading scientists from 40 countries who all got together and examined more than 6,000 scientific studies about the environment and about global warming and about climate change and about a jillion other things going on with that little tiny blue dot that we call home. And they are all members of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. It's a group of scientists that was convened by the United Nations to make recommendations to world leaders. And our president wanted to know who drew the report, like with a crayon, or I'm not really sure what that means, but they want to know what group drew it. Who came up with this? What's the angle? What's the political gain here? And I think I'm doesn't bother me anymore. I'm used to all that stuff. And I think the current president speaks for many people because it hasn't affected them directly. It's much like the denial thing that I've brought up many times. And I think it applies across the board. When things aren't the way we think they should be, or we haven't been impacted by something as we were told we would, then it doesn't exist. And I know people in my family who smoked for years. The doctor says, this is going to kill you. Oh, no, it isn't. I'm invincible. Not going to kill me. I'll be the only person who it doesn't kill. It killed him. And until you're laying there with a catheter up your, you know what, going, how did this happen? How did I get into this position? All of a sudden, the rational mind kicks back in. So as the storm's intensity of all these hurricanes and things start to increase, and we start to brace ourselves for, you know, these onslaughts of weather that we've not experienced in our very short time here, 150 years is nothing. I started to think, and interestingly enough, it started raining when I sat down to record this. And I think about how you have to have leverage on yourself to deny science in favor of something else that fits in there so we feel better, I guess. I'm not really sure. And I always wonder if people understand or get that we don't get any new water. There's never been a new drop of water created on the planet. It's just a recycling system. So the water that comes out of the aquifers and it gets bottled in some exotic source that can be put into a plastic bottle so somebody in Cleveland can drink it, or how about Flint, Michigan, where the water's still shitty, that's the same water that's been here since there was water. You can argue what year that was, a billion years ago. I don't effing know. That's not the point. But we don't get any new water. And so when I see the picture of the Earth, and most of it is blue, ocean, and you see this, you know, this salt water that we haven't tapped in as a resource yet, they're trying to figure out ways to do desalination, that's for sure. There could be some help there, but we've already been using up what we have in a way that the aquifers can't keep up. So as it's raining right now, this is the same rain that came down. It will work itself through the grass in the backyard. It'll get into the aquifers here, and it'll be all recycled back, and it takes time for that to happen. And when humans add things into the ground or into the water that was never intended, then you got to go through a whole process to make sure that that doesn't end up killing people. So that's just on that part of it. But as these wild swings in weather start to take place, it is, to me, no different than someone who's been smoking for 30 years. And the doc's like, I told you 10 years ago to stop. Yeah, I got a cough, but it'll go away. This stuff is already impacting people around the world. And just because it hasn't impacted you in your backyard, that doesn't mean it doesn't exist. It just means it hasn't impacted you. So all of this to me is about the same perspective that they saw looking back at our planet from so far away. We have nowhere else to go. That right there should be the only rational conversation point. We have nowhere else to go. You can look around. There's nowhere to go. There's nowhere to go. This is it. So we make our stand here or we don't. Every great civilization has come and gone. We think we're immune. I don't know why, because we got cool phones. I have no clue. But eventually, something will come about in our own backyard, and then we'll go, no, why didn't somebody tell me about this? I always think if, you know, in Chicago, where I grew up, where I live now, they spend thousands of dollars on their yard. Take care of it, mow it, make it look nice, pick up garbage, you know, that flies across it. And I think most homeowners take a great sense of pride in where they live and how they live and what they do with that. Can you imagine if a lot of what was going on in the world environmentally just happened on one person's yard? You know, the oil spills and the shit coming up to the ground and the toxic leaks and the storms and the weathers, they'd take notice then. And so all of this stuff to me is intertwined. But we like to have our pivot points. We like to say, nah, I can go with you to this point, but I'm not going to go any further on that. I wrote a rant, I guess, last week about all that's been going on politically. And it started out talking how I don't know anybody who thinks that gravity is not real. We've all accepted basically that gravity is a real thing. It's what keeps us on the planet. We get to stand upright, and what goes up comes down. And it was old Isaac Newton who figured all this stuff out. He has three laws that I learned. There's actually a fourth, which you may not know, but I'll let you know about that in a few seconds. Those three laws of motion I learned back in, you know, Mr. Andler's fifth grade science class. This is basic stuff. And the thing about these laws, they're physical laws. They're not federal laws or state laws. They are physical laws. That means none of us are exempt. No exemptions. Whether you're Republican, Democrat, or other, whether you're black, white, red, yellow, whether you're man, woman, child, doesn't matter. These are physical laws, and they apply across the board to everybody all the time. And as I would have in my mind sometimes, there are these laws that are physical laws, and sometimes I think they transfer over into spiritual laws or emotional laws and things that we don't often look at. So that's what's been on my mind when I wrote this thing last week about gravity and how we all agree that gravity exists. Yes. Oh, yeah. Okay, great. We're all finding common ground on gravity. These three laws, of course, the first one is an object remains at rest or continues to move at a constant velocity unless acted upon by a force. So if you're sitting at a stoplight and a semi hits you, you're going to move a little bit. Or if you're driving down the side roads and you get T-boned by a Cadillac, you're going to go in another direction. So the object, the body, the person that stays at rest unless something moves on it or something intercedes and is acted upon by an outside force. The second law, let me just give it to you scientifically so I sound really smart here. In an inertial reference frame, the vector sum of the force is F. Vector sum of the force is F. On an object is equal to the mass, m, of that object, multiplied by the acceleration, which will be stated as a of the object. F equals ma. It is assumed here that the mass is a constant, which leads us to number three, my favorite law. Outside of Isaac Newton inventing Fig Newtons, this is the best thing I think he ever came up with. When one body exerts a force on a second body, the second body simultaneously exerts a force equal in magnitude and opposite in direction of the first force, class dismissed. When a body exerts a force on a second body simultaneously exerts a force equal in magnitude and opposite in direction of the first body. So if you've ever been, now these were popular back in the day, I don't see very many of these anymore, but there was a thing called Newton's cradle. People would have them on their desk, and there was these steel balls all in a row hanging by a little wire. And if you started the one on the left end in motion, click. The one on the other side goes up and comes back, click. And then the other one goes up and comes back, click. That is Newton's third law in action. The body stays at rest until something acts upon it. And when it acts upon it, it comes back the same way it started, back and forth, click, clack, click, clack. That stuff will drive you bonkers. It's called politics. It's called human behavior. The thing about it is, most of the force is exerted through the middle, where most people live, and sit and watch this shit back and forth and back and forth. The middle never changes. Neither does the outside. It just goes back and forth. Newton's cradle exemplifies so much of what's going on in the world today. Now, the fourth law that you may or may not have remembered is the principle of superposition. And this really sums it all up for me. In physics, as in system theories, the superposition principle states that for all linear systems, which we all run in lines, think about it, the net response caused by two or more of the stimuli is the sum of the responses that would have been caused by each stimulus individually. So if A produces a response X and B produces response Y, then input A plus B produces X plus Y, the whole ball of wax. Let me break it all down for you a little different. If you want to keep getting what you're getting, keep doing what you're doing. If you want the same results, just keep doing the same thing. Click, clack, click, clack, click, clack. Ass kicked in the middle. Click, clack. This is what we do. Right now, we're coming into the election season here in Illinois, I'm watching a barrage of absurd commercials. Absurd commercials, 30 seconds long. The networks love this stuff. That's where all the money that's raised gets spent trying to convince people that one's evil and one's good. 30 seconds. And they run these ads because they work on some level. I think you have to be in a coma of sorts or so buried in your confirmation bias that you can go, yeah, that's true. They're highly produced, highly edited, all to appeal to something in a brain. Click, clack, click, clack, click, clack. Back and forth, back and forth. And in the middle, all the rest of this stuff, we're supposed to live our lives. Those are Newton's four laws. They apply across the board. And when I was watching that documentary I mentioned earlier, I started to think about The Wizard of Oz a little bit. There's no place like home. Dorothy could not wait to get back to that farm. It was great to go on this wonderful adventure with all its perils and ups and downs and all the cool things and all the horrible things. But really, there was no place like home. And I think so many people long for that feeling. But as I watched that documentary and I went back, and if you're seeing this advertisement or whatever you want to call it, the billboard on Facebook, I use the Earthrise picture, and you look back 150,000 miles from the lunar surface as the Apollo crew did, and you realize, no, there's really no other place like home. No place has the water, the atmosphere. The biosphere is perfect in its design. Whether you think it's divine design or whatever is not relevant. What's relevant is we are stewards of the biosphere. There's nowhere else to go. Nowhere. Take a look at the picture. This is it. We make our stand or we take our fall right here. And so as these reports come out, talking about we have X amount of years to kind of right the ship a little bit, the Earth will not implode. The Earth will go on. The passengers on planet Earth, that's a different story. It's already happening. It's already happening. But as I've mentioned, the DNA of denial is very strong in humans, and if it doesn't fit your grid, then it's not a problem. It's only a problem until it becomes our problem. And then we want to know why somebody didn't fix it. So with that in mind, here is Earth Matters with Bill Curtis.
He was perhaps the most celebrated astronomer of our time. His curiosity of the cosmos not only made him a champion of space exploration, but also a great defender of planet Earth. To millions, Carl Sagan's name is synonymous with the Emmy Award-winning Cosmos. Sagan had played a leading role in the space program since its inception. He concluded after many years that the most interesting and diverse forms of life would not be found in some distant star system, but rather right here on Earth. The final edition of Cosmos was titled, Who Speaks for Earth? And pointed out that each and every one of us is charged with being a steward of this incredible planet in any way that we can. Reaching for the stars, Carl Sagan left a legacy that resonates stronger than ever. Earth Matters. I'm Bill Curtis.
I don't know what else to say. I'm sitting here thinking at some point, why do I even do this anymore? This is like spitting into the wind. Is it going to change anybody's mind? No. If you already think what I'm talking about makes sense, you're probably already doing something of some conscious level to, you know, pay your rent for the space you take up on the planet in some small way. And if you think what I'm saying is bullshit, you probably turn it off a half hour ago anyway. So I'm not sure why I do this, except as I've mentioned, I think there's some salvation points in here for me. The people that come before me that I found their work to be important in the world. Otherwise, it would have gone to shit. You know, I've said before, Teddy Roosevelt's picture's on my desk. Every morning I walk in a report to the 26th president. And I recall the time in 1908, I believe it was, where Congress was considering opening the Grand Canyon for mining because there's money in there. Listen, for all the high-mindedness in the world, there's a lot of people that would just take and take and take until there's nothing left. It happens all the time. Should be no surprise there. And until TR stepped in and said, you cannot improve on this. You can only make it worse. And so he invoked the Antiquities Act and he saved a bunch of things. And I have no doubt that humans would have plundered and pillaged as much as they could possibly get back in the day for a buck until they're gone. That hasn't changed much. So when I sit at my desk in the morning and I see TR's face here, I kind of feel like, okay, Prez, what do you want me to do today? What little piece can I put of the puzzle in place while I'm here? This is all I got at this point. I have a microphone, a Zoom machine, a 7-year-old Dell laptop, and a few subscribers who like to listen. That's about all I can do. That's my stump. That's my bully pulpit. If I didn't do this, I don't know that I could look at myself in the morning. I really don't. And so while there have been many times that I have faltered on this path of broadcasting what I think is information that's somewhat important with some sort of implications that we can do far better than we're doing now, I have not wavered from that. The platform has taken different, routes, but the message has been constant and the same for me. And so I hope in some small way that you remember that perspective matters. There's nowhere else to go. Even if it's just the thought of, listen, when I was a kid, I remember my dad dumping oil from the car into the sewer on the street. My dad was a great guy, didn't know any better. Nobody cared. This was the 60s and the 70s. It wasn't until 1970 when Earth Day came around and the Cuyahoga River was on fire in Ohio, and it made the news that people went, oh, maybe there should be so much shit in a river that it catches fire. There's a thought. And I had a few conversations with my dad over the years, and pretty soon he'd be like, yeah, maybe that's not a good thing. Well, you know, if you dump it in the sewer, it gets clean, doesn't it? No, Dad, it doesn't. So it takes time for people to change their consciousness, if they change at all. Environmental things, environmental stewardship, to me is common sense, but it's not common practice because it takes a conscious effort to do those things. It takes recycling stuff you would usually bury in the ground. It's take a little bit of time. So I think of TR often. And as I mentioned before, Jacques Cousteau was a huge influence on me. I was watching another documentary this week from 1952, like The Living Sea or something, stuff I would have seen in grammar school in the 60s. You know, it's a documentary in very, technicolor with music behind it, and they were showing the Great Barrier Reef off Australia, teeming with life and all these amazing things and different parts around the world, and the last unexplored wilderness is under the water. In just, 60 years, you go back to the Great Barrier Reef and it is not so great. Humans did that. They were pulling king crab up like you wouldn't believe. And they would throw the small ones back, the little males back, and say, nothing is wasted here. And then you saw all the dead fish on board that never got thrown back. But we have these immeasurable impacts on the planet. They all add up like Newton's laws. You take one and two, put them together, and pretty soon three and four show up, and you got shit creek. And all I'm saying is, whether you think we're not responsible at all, which I find totally delirious in denial, how about 1%? Is it possible that humans are 1% for the climate shift? Just 1%? How about 0.5%? How about 0.33%? That the billions of tons of carbon we put into the air, some way, shape, or form is changing the biosphere we depend on for life. So 0.5%, can you do that? Because if we just can be 0.5% and not 99% responsible, like we've screwed it all up, let's live in the middle somewhere. What if it's 50-50? Do you not do whatever it takes to make sure that we are responsible for our half or our 1/3% of the influence we have in the world? And then in the next 10, 15, 20 years, it's going to get worse and may not ever get better. And then in the long run, the earth will go on, but the rest of us, it's going to get very difficult. So there's the Wednesday rant. Not a lot of wisdom there, I'm afraid. I'm not feeling it today. I'm sitting here wondering, it's like they say knowledge is power. It's only power if you use it. Otherwise, it's just information. Information can lead to transformation, but it has to put in place. It has to be acted upon. And while there's not much I can do about what's going on in the government and what kind of regulations they have and all those kind of things, that doesn't mean I shouldn't do something. I find it amazing with issues that we like to, slap bumper stickers on about certain issues, abortion, veterans, you name it, fill in the blank. And I always say to people when they have an issue with an issue, what are you doing to make the issue better besides casting a vote or thinking somebody in elected office will do it? I'm a veteran. I go to the VA 3-4 times a year, and I walk in and see untold numbers of veterans, a lot of them alone, in various degrees of declining health. And anybody that thinks that veterans should be treated better should go into a VA facility and treat a veteran better. Not wait for a government mandate. Not wait for a rollout. Not wait for anything except one time a month. One day a month, go into the VA and say, I want to volunteer. I want to make a veteran's life a little bit better. Then you won't be so effing worried about the veterans aren't being treated well. I say to people, listen, I'm not always popular where I go because authenticity isn't always the best thing. People want bigger, faster, stronger yesterday without having to pay for it. If abortion is your issue, then go to an orphanage. Go adopt a kid that nobody wanted that slipped through the cracks. If it's all about right to life, then go find one kid who deserves to have a life and make that happen. You won't spend so much time thinking that the church should do it or the president should do it. Or you go, when you get involved with issues, you have less issue with it because you're actually involved in it, doing something to make it better. Instead of sitting back going, woulda, coulda, and shoulda. That's where things change. So for me, the environmental piece is as simple as I know the recycling. If I do nothing else, I've done everything I can. A 90-10 ratio for me, 90% of what we put out goes into the recycling. I can do that. It makes me feel like, you know what? That's what I can do today. And I know once your consciousness changes, it will lead you to something that you can do. And that's when there's some empowerment. That's when it makes it all worthwhile. My old buddy John Denver came up with something similar. If not you, who? And if not now, when? 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 Thanks for listening. Thanks for subscribing. Safe travels. Until next time, adios.